Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1202, we bring you four Life Rattle classics. Two from 1990, written and read by Martha McLaughlin, whose Radio Caravan we heard last week, and two stories last aired in 1989, written and read by Kathy Barney. Tonight's first writer, Martha McLaughlin, was born in Toronto and lived in Thunder Bay, Sault Ste. Marie, and Duluth, Minnesota, before she returned to Toronto in 1983, where she worked organized co-op housing. We've been out of touch with Martha for almost 20 years, so her Life Rattle bio ends there. Martha, if you're listening, please get in touch with us. Arnie Achtman described Martha's first story tonight as having an atmosphere that is dark around the edges with a deep sense of mystery. Dreaming, the dream of a young single mother, is shot through with fear and uncertainty. People walk in disjointed fashion and the narrator cannot recognize houses on a familiar street. The dream turns into a nightmare and the narrator becomes a paralyzed witness to her worst fears. Let's listen now to Dreaming, written and read by Martha McLaughlin.
I'm dreaming. It's almost dawn. My best friend Rosie and I sit in my mother's living room, come dining room. My father sits at the table in his green work pants and plaid wool shirt. He wears the hat my mother curses. For God's sakes, Tom, either wash that hat or wear the new one I bought you. They're having tea. Rosie and I sit on the couch and look through a box of photographs. They're black and white. The room is barely illuminated by the sun coming up. The pictures start moving rapidly. I don't know if our hands are moving them. Images of aunts, cousins, memories of my parents' past. It looks like an old film, everyone moving in a disjointed fashion. We walk down the street. The houses are dark. The street sleeps. I want to tell her who lives in each house, but I don't recognize them. Something has changed. Maybe I'm tired. Home, in our flat above the cleaners, I lie in my bed terrified, petrified. My eyes are wide open. My limbs are rigid. Rosie's room is next to mine. I'll call her. I have no voice. The wall is thin. I'll beat it with my fist. My heart constricts. My stomach is filled with dread. Something awful is happening. I continue to lie there facing the door. I can't blink. I can't turn my head. The door opens slightly. In her cream-colored gown, face pale, blonde hair in a bun, she comes in slowly. In the dark room, she brings light. Her warm presence releases the hold on me. My hand reaches out towards her. I hear my strangled voice. Rosie. Her hands are over her head. She brings down a knife. Up and down, plunging it into the baby, pulling it out, up, then down again. There's no blood, no cries, no color in the room, no sounds. I am paralyzed again. Rosie wanted me to have this baby. Always she planned, gushed about how wonderful it would be to have this baby in our home. I know where we can get a bassinet, Martha. I picked up the most wonderful outfit for the baby. I'll put them in the bassinet for now. She kept it in her room. Before the birth, she insisted I take the larger room. Still, I had no room to accommodate this small person's belongings. I'm seeing the children's aid worker tomorrow. I arrested her enthusiasm at every chance. An abortion would have been less brutal. Now the baby is murdered. I can't go look. I'm not sure what I want to find. The baby is dead. Therefore, I have no child. The sun is stronger. In the thin light, I reach for my jewel box. I find the pearl beads intertwined in silver. I wrap the beads around my hand and hold the cross with both. The room is becoming brighter. It wasn't Rosie. It was a ghost. This place is haunted. Some tormented soul has come back. With my rosary in hand, I arise from my bed. Trance-like, I walk over to the small bassinet. She lies there sleeping, her small chest rising, breathing in rhythm. I had the worst nightmare last night. I dreamt I woke up terrified, petrified, and this ghost was stabbing Sarah. We're having tea.
That was Martha McLaughlin reading her story, Dreaming. In her second story tonight, Martha tells us of a startling encounter with a blind man. From a beginning of curiosity and casual chatter between two people who meet on the bus, to an almost intrusive grilling and graphic commentary, their conversation bizarrely moves into private territory. Let's listen now to Blind, written and read by Martha McLaughlin.
I watched him get on the bus. He showed his pass to the driver, and immediately a young man got up. There's a seat here for you. He seemed prepared to say thank you even before he tapped the few steps into the interior of the bus. He sat down across from me and placed his white cane between his legs. I felt self-conscious staring at him, so I closed my eyes. I mused on being blind. Imagine not seeing the other people on the bus. Being oblivious to the commotion on the street, I opened my eyes when the bus stopped at Dundas. He didn't seem disturbed as people got on and off. It probably wasn't his stop yet. How did he know? I figured he was around 50. He wore a gray herringbone overcoat and a matching hat with a feather on the left side. The hair that showed was gray, too. The cane and sunglasses were the only outstanding part of his outfit. I imagined putting my clothes on without sight. You can feel if your clothes are inside out or on backwards. But someone has to shop and coordinate the colors. At Queen Street, I broke away from him and made my way to the middle exit. As I walked to the corner, I saw him waiting at the curb. The light turned green and the Queen streetcar was waiting. I asked him if he was taking it. Yes, he was, so I walked with him to the streetcar. Because I made the contact, I thought it rude to distance myself. I sat beside him and asked how far he was going. Just to Young Street, and how about you? Where are you going? To Bond Street, the stop past Young. What's there? Only St. Michael's Hospital, as I recall. Is that where you're going? Yes, I have an appointment. Are you sick? No. Well, tell me, why would you go to a hospital, then? I'm going to have a baby. I'm seeing my doctor. I now felt self-conscious for confessing my condition and for using the word seeing. It must happen to them all the time. Isn't that wonderful? When? In April. That's not even 2 months from now. You and your husband must be very excited. I didn't tell him how I felt about it, but I did say there was no husband. Why was I so open? He couldn't see that I was pregnant, not married. My dear, this is terrible. What will you do? I'll be fine. Don't worry about me. Listen, how long will you be at the doctor's? You can meet me for coffee after. My business will only take about an hour. I had no reason to refuse. Fine, at Woolworth's. Say 3:30 in a coffee shop? Fine. And off he went with the crowd at Young Street. He negotiated well. I put him out of my mind and concentrated on destination. The maternity clinic. This was only my second checkup. The first had been at the 6 months point. By then it was too late to have an abortion. My girlfriend insisted I get a doctor at the hospital. I needed a place to have the baby. People often stared at me in the clinic. It infuriated me. Now when I see young girls pregnant, I understand why they looked. Children having children is not easily dismissed. I was glad to get off the examining table and get out. Doctors make me uncomfortable, vulnerable to their probing questions and hands. I walked to Yonge Street slowly. I wanted to forget the coffee appointment, but kept walking towards Woolworths. Of all places, that's where you go with your mother after shopping. I walked through the store to the coffee shop. He was sitting facing the entrance. That's how I sit when I'm meeting a friend. I sat down across from him and said hello. He seemed surprised. We didn't know each other's names, so we made introductions. Ordering coffee took up some more time. He insisted I needed a muffin. I asked him questions. Did he have a wife? He produced an envelope with pictures. I saw pictures of him with Phil Givens, the mayor, and a middle-aged, well-dressed woman. She was having a painting mounted at City Hall. I was impressed. I didn't know any artists yet. I still wanted to know about being blind. He'd never seen the painting his wife did, and there he was at the reception. Handicaps intimidated me. My questions seemed too personal to ask. When you're older, it's easier to be direct. He wanted to know about me. Where was the baby's father? Why wasn't I married? How could I explain? Being pregnant was bad enough. I didn't want to get married. I was trying to forget about Doug. He had forgotten about me quick and easy enough. He kept asking and I kept answering. How could this happen? You could get birth control pills. I didn't like doctors. How old was I? How old was Doug? Where did this happen? Was Doug still in Vancouver? If he was in Toronto, why was I letting him away with this? A young man must face responsibility. What about abortion? I told him I saw a doctor at the York Finch Hospital, at the insistence of a friend. He had a picture of his three kids on the desk. I focused my eyes on the picture while he described the difference between the vacuum procedure and the saline solution. He told me if I decided quickly, he could use the vacuum method to remove the fetus. Otherwise, he'd have to inject the saline solution into my belly and force the fetus to disengage. I didn't repeat the description of the vacuum procedure and the saline method. The doctor hadn't used either one on his wife, obviously. I was embarrassed. Certainly I knew about birth control at 18 years of age. If no birth controls, why didn't he use a rubber? You know, condoms. You can't just have sex without thinking. It's not like having a coffee with someone. Didn't we know other sexual techniques? You can masturbate each other. Did you try 69? Oral sex is good. Would you let him put it in your mouth? It's clean, you know, and there would be no babies. All my decisions were emotional, and he was being so factual, so graphic. My face and neck were blazing. I have never been able to hide my embarrassment or nervousness. If only he'd been afflicted with paralysis of the mouth and not the eyes. Yes, we were in love and had made love. It was our first times. We weren't following a book. His words cheapened my love affair. He finally realized my responses had dried up. He slowed his questions down and wanted to know if I would keep the baby. I said I didn't know. I had to go. It was getting late. Yes, all right then. He was late too and was ready to leave. I didn't want to meet him. I wanted to leave when he was talking about sex. Still, I waited while he fumbled with his money to pay the cashier. You don't walk out on blind people, even if they are perverts. He wanted to know if I was getting back on the streetcar, so I said no. I was taking the subway. Maybe he'd go that way, too. I walked at his pace down the steps to the station. It was rush hour, and we were jostled together. I was repulsed. When we neared the turnstile, he changed his mind. He'd rather take the streetcar. I directed him to the exit. "Martha, you're a nice girl," he said, and shook my hand. He pressed something into my palm and walked away. Quickly. It was a $10 bill. I felt like a whore. I saw him about a month later. I was walking through Simpson's Budget Store. He was at the honeydew counter having a drink. I blushed and turned back. I hurried out of the store. Only after getting outside, I remembered he was blind.
That was Martha McLaughlin reading her story, Blind. The next two stories come from even deeper in the Life Rattle archive, from 1989. Tonight's second reader, Kathy Barney, came to Toronto from Guelph. Her story, Our Toronto, takes place in the early 1980s in a pool hall and a greasy spoon on Queen Street, before Queen Street was trendy. The narrator, a regular at the pool hall, presents an ordinary weekday there. Most of the regulars are out of work. They go to the pool hall instead of the office. They drink coffee, they read the paper, and they see familiar faces. The lifestyle is outside the law, but not in a romanticized, unrealistic way. Drug abuse and theft are presented simply and undramatically. The narrator observes the characters without judging them, and so lets us see them more realistically. That is, less sensationally than most accounts of this community. Let's listen now to Our Toronto, written and read by Kathy Barney.
I sat on a plastic milk crate in a back corner of the pool hall, reading the Globe. 8 of the 10 pool tables were being used. Most of the customers were businessmen from the neighboring offices on their lunch hour. Brian Davis and Mike Marshall were on table 3. Mike dealt dope out of the hall between noon and 4 o'clock on weekdays. Business hours, he said. A bunch of school kids hung around the front counter, eating pizza and potato chips, getting in the way of the serious players. Melody slumped across from me on the floor. She had just done a hit of junk. She was on the nod, half a roast beef sandwich dangled from one hand. I waited for it to fall. Beside me were 2 broken pinball machines and a collection of 15 or 20 cues, broken or needing new tips. A metal mop bucket with a wringer on the side sat in the middle of the floor. The bucket was close to overflowing with greenish water in which floated cigarette butts and a Coke can. An empty vodka bottle was wedged behind one of the pinball machines. Rick Woodhouse sat next to Melody on another milk crate, drinking coffee, his huge black hands wrapped around the styrofoam cup. "What's new, Kate?" he asked. "Ah, nothing. I'm bored." I turned to the crossword puzzle. Peter Campbell looked over my shoulder. "I don't know how you do those things. Cryptics," he said, peering at the page. "Oh, they're not so hard once you know the tricks," I said. Peter sat down on a milk crate. "Here comes Keith." I looked up. Keith walked down the aisle between the pool tables with a scowl on his face. He was thin and balding. He wore a beige top coat and Italian loafers with tassels. A cream-colored knit dress was draped over his arm. He stuck it under our noses. "Look at this, that fucking kid. I was showing this to Sam at the counter, and one of those fucking kids spilled a pop on it. How the fuck am I supposed to sell this? $800. I got to get a couple hundred for it." "Where'd you pinch it from?" I asked, rubbing the silky wool between my fingers. "Eaton's, $600. He said, holding up the dress. "And this is $250. He held up a matching shawl. "Hey, you're abroad? How do you get this stain out? You want to take it in the can for me and try and get it out?" "I don't want to wreck it. I'll have to get it all wet, you know." "I don't care. It's wrecked now. Do whatever you can. That fucking kid." I took the dress into the washroom. The hot water tap came off in my hand. I turned on the cold, grabbed a paper towel, and rubbed some of the dirt out of the sink. I soaked the top half of the dress. The fresh stain disappeared quickly. The material was too heavy to wring out properly with my cold hands, so I gathered it up, dripping, and took it out to show Keith. "The stain came out great. You can't even see where it was. This material is really gorgeous." Hey, that's great it came out, eh? Just great. Don't worry, it'll dry somehow. As long as it's not a write-off. I gotta make some money today, Keith said. Here, Peter said. Here's what you do. He jumped up, grabbed a cue out of the corner, and draped the wet dress over it. He stood on a milk crate and slung the cue across two pipes up near the ceiling. The dress dripped water onto the floor. Melody looked up at it. Shit, she said. Where'd that come from? She stuck out her foot and hit the mop bucket. Dirty water sloshed over the side. Christ, look what you're doing, man, Rick shouted. Look at this place, it's disgusting. He laughed. Man, you know that radio station? Candlelight shit. Where that guy reads that thing, The Sounds of Our Toronto? Ever hear that? Well, this is our Toronto. You got this crap on the floor, you got the needles falling out of the arms, you got the swag hanging up to dry. Ain't it wonderful, I said. Hey, what time is it? I could use a beer. Yeah, come on, Peter said. See you later, Keith. Peter, Rick, and I went out the back door of the pool hall, through the alley, and across Queen Street, dodging traffic. I opened the door of the Blue Moon restaurant. See that, I said, pointing at a telephone hanging behind the front counter. I swear that phone has stuff growing out of the mouthpiece. Fur, you can see it. We sat in one of the booths and ordered beers. Each wall featured a different color of flocked wallpaper. Green, yellow, orange, and near the front door, red. I looked around at the old men drinking. Some of them had cuts and bruises on their faces. Some of them shook. Hey, watch this guy, I said, kicking Rick under the table. One of the old geezers slowly slid out of his chair, a melancholy expression on his face. He ended up on the floor, beer glass still in his hand. His companion looked down at him, perplexed. The waitress marched over grimly. I raised my glass. Our Toronto, I said. Our Toronto, said Rick and Peter. Our glasses clinked.
That was Kathy Barney reading her story, Our Toronto. Kathy's second story tonight, Paul, brings the story's namesake to life, as freshly out of jail Paul, a brilliant character who the narrator describes as bearing a resemblance to William Burroughs, convinces his friends to go to the racetrack. Let's find out about that adventure now as we listen to Paul, written and read by Kathy Barney.
It was Paul's idea to go to the racetrack. Naturally, he assumed Dave or I would pay for everything. Paul was just out of jail and broke. After a night of drinking, he was up early, showing no bad effects, prodding and cajoling to get me moving. I groaned. Paul needed only 4 or 5 hours of sleep, and I resented his clear-headedness and brisk manner. He had no patience with slow or stupid people, or whiners. I rolled carefully off the sofa, holding my head. Dave was still asleep on the floor. His right hand rested in an ashtray full of butts and beer caps. Paul leaned over him, his face an inch away from Dave's ear, and snapped in a loud military command, "All right, move it." Dave mumbled something and rolled over onto the ashtray. His head banged into the TV set. "Shit," he said. He sat up, holding the offending ashtray. His chest hair was covered with ashes. A beer cap pressed into the skin above his elbow. Paul was pleased with our progress. I stumbled into the kitchen. Paul stood at the stove in his underwear, scratching his chin, waiting for water to boil in a pot. The pot had a jagged stub of broken handle. He used a dirty oven mitt to pick it up and pour water over instant coffee in 3 cracked mugs. "Jesus Christ, look at you. You look like William Burroughs on a bad day. You really need to gain some weight," I said, frowning. He did look like Burroughs. The gaunt, mournful, yet deadly serious face, and thin, erect body. Paul was in his mid-40s, but his skin was starting to stretch and toughen like an old man. His chest seemed transparent. He laughed at me. "Drink up. Let's go." He sped energetically into the living room with a cup of coffee. I sat looking out the window into the alley. The guy from downstairs came out with a bucket to wash his car. He turned on the tape deck, and Portuguese music blared up into the narrow space. I reached for the bottle of 222s. Paul reappeared in a wrinkled white shirt and suit pants. He wore brown leather loafers with tassels and no socks. His short hair was wet and combed straight back from his forehead. He picked lint off the suit jacket. "The lapels are too wide," I remarked. I know," he said impatiently. "I hate this fucking suit. It's murder. You ready?" He helped himself to the 222s, shaking them in his hand as if he was going to toss dice. "Give me 5 minutes," I said, heading for the bathroom. When I came out, Dave was squinting into a piece of mirror, trimming his mustache with a pair of school scissors. His gut hung out over his jeans. Paul hurried him into his jacket. We all clattered down the fire escape to Dave's car. "Better grab a six-pack," Paul said. He twisted the radio dial until he got the Stones singing Honky Tonk Woman. He turned it up. We drove with the windows down, slurping greedily from the cans of beer. Paul smacked his lips. "God damn, isn't it just a beautiful day," he said. The sun was out, but the air was heavy and damp. When we got to the track, it started to drizzle. The sun blinked in and out. We were in time for the second race. We watched it outside, standing in the light rain. None of us won anything. In the third race, I won $18 on a $2 bet. We voted to sit inside and watch the rest of the races on TV. Paul grabbed the table and went to the bar for drinks. Dave studied his racing form. The waiter came over with 3 beers. Paul jerked his head, indicating I would pay. I bought the round. I upped my bet to $5 and loaned Paul 10. Dave won in the fourth. He bought the next 2 rounds. Dave and I talked about going to Louisville for the Kentucky Derby. He had friends in Nashville we could visit. I turned to include Paul in the conversation, but he was looking over my shoulder at the next table. "Poor old bastard," he said in a faraway voice. Dave and I followed his glance. "Don't stare at him now. Let him be now," Paul chided. The man was in his 70s, sitting alone at a table, his eyes fixed on the television, his hand locked around a glass of whiskey. He was very fat, rolls around his chin, huge stomach and thighs. He had a black Homburg on the back of his head and a greasy yellowed shirt with buttons missing stretched across his stomach. He wore an old black suit that had been expensive when it was new. He sat with his legs apart. He had pissed himself several times over the last few hours or days, each time leaving a dried stain that spread halfway down his leg. The stains were gradated like the rings on a tree trunk. "Poor old boy," Paul repeated, jumping up. "Give me a fin," he said. I pushed my change across the table. He bought a glass of whiskey from the bartender and carried it carefully over to the old man. "Here," he said gently, "I just thought you might like a drink. Are you okay? Are you all right?" The man turned and looked at Paul. His eyes were staring. He nodded, almost imperceptibly. Then he turned back to the television. Paul hesitated beside the table for a minute. Then he brushed something from the sleeve of the old man's jacket. "Okay," he said. "You're okay now." He came and sat down again with Dave and I. He looked thoughtful and far away.
That was Kathy Barney reading her story, Paul. That concludes Life Rattle number 1202. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded both Martha McLaughlin and Kathy Barney reading their stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Sunday night at 9 to hear more stories.